If you ache for truth, goodness, and beauty, if you're hungry for a Christianity with substance and strength, if you long for a faith that's big and bold and biblical and all about Jesus Christ, if you're inspired by the idea of one church that has spanned 20 centuries, 24 time zones, and two hemispheres, enfolding every race, nation, and language, then you're considering Catholicism. Welcome back to Considering Catholicism. My name is Greg, your host, and I am here, as I often am, with Corey.
Good afternoon, or I guess whatever time it is for you.
Yeah, whatever. I mean, that's sort of an interesting sort of philosophical question, is what time is it? Is it the time that we're recording or the time that they're listening?
I don't know.
So anyway. So speaking of interesting questions, we had a question come in. And by the way, we get a lot of great email from you. You write in and you share your stories and you share your comments and you share your questions. You either do that via email or by posting a message on our website. And I love to get those. In fact, there are so many questions coming in that we can't answer them all on the air. I try to answer some of them offline in email, and we try to answer what we can on air. But we did have a really interesting question come in, or a series of questions.
Yes.
from a young man, a teenager. His name is Caden. And Caden wrote in a series of questions, but they all had to do with, well, warrior monks.
Ooh.
Which is totally a cool idea. Now, Caden's a young guy, and he is intrigued by the idea of warrior monks. And frankly, who wouldn't be intrigued by that? And particularly what he was asking about were the monastic orders, what are known as the military orders during the Crusades. These were religious orders, Catholic religious orders, right? Orders of monks. Mm-hmm. Well, they're sort of like monks, and they were sort of like fighting men.
It's a bit of a crossover.
They were knights, K-N-I-G-H-T-S. They were fighting knights who took religious vows and organized themselves as a Catholic religious order to go over and fight the Crusades, like the Knights Templar, the Hospitallers, the Teutonic Knights, Knights of Malta, all this,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And so Caden was asking about those and how they developed, what they did, what happened to them, because are there warrior monks around today? So I thought, wow, of all these questions that you guys send in, and there are so many great ones, but I loved Caden's question. I thought it was a great opportunity to talk about something that's interesting and fun, and it actually draws in an awful lot of Catholic history.
Yeah, because you have to explore the context to make any sense of it. Otherwise, it seems kind of an anomaly.
Yeah, now we did do an episode on the Crusades, mm-hmm, at one point, and I'll post the link to that episode in the show notes. But I thought, well, this is a question that I need Corey to help me tackle. So I called him up and I said, hey, we got to answer Caden's question here. And as we talked about it, I quickly realized that to answer Quaden's question about the fighting military monks of the Crusades, we actually have to go back about 600 years earlier to make sense of it.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't just pop out of the blue. It wasn't like when the Crusades came, somebody said, hey, like, let's have warrior monks. It was something that developed over time, or the concept developed, or
have a certain foundation of ideas and societal constructs in order for that to ever occur to anyone, for that to be able to happen.
What he said.
Yeah.
And so I thought, well, okay, to tell this story, we have to go back and talk about all of the things that led up to it. And so we're going to actually answer Caden's question with a two parts here. This is going to be part one of the warrior monks.
Episode one
of the warrior monk story. And then in part two, which will release in a few days, we'll have, well, part two. So let's dive into part one and go back to the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to understand this and to make sense of, as Corey says, the sort of social, cultural, religious, civilizational constructs or whatnot that led to the creation of the military orders. To frame that, I want to talk about something that was really critical to understanding the medieval mind in the early to middle ages,
right?
So the Middle Ages is often sort of broken up into three rough periods, right? And by the way, the Middle Ages, just so people realize, lasted over 1,000 years.
It's a long time.
As I remember when I studied medieval history, I had a professor who liked to point out that the Middle Ages lasted longer than the period since the Middle Ages until now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And twice as long. In fact, if you think about the 2,000-year history of the Catholic Church, half of the history of the Catholic Church was lived during the Middle Ages.
Yeah.
Okay. It lasted over 1,000 years from the fall of the Western Roman Empire, and we'll get into that in a minute, and till the fall of Constantinople, listed as in 1453.
Yeah, but however you want to slice it about the 15th century.
Yeah. So in any case, let's go back to the Middle Ages, again, being divided into three parts. You have the early Middle Ages right after the fall of the Roman Empire, Western mm-hmm. Roman Empire. You have the sort of middle Ages when new systems and structures and society was developing something that we call Christendom. And then you have kind of the high Middle Ages when all of these things that had been percolating and growing came to full bloom. And that's where you have Dante and Thomas Aquinas and the Chartres Cathedral and the universities and all this kind of great stuff, right?
Yep.
Okay. So let's go back, though, to the fall of the Western Roman Empire. So during the early to middle Ages, there were writers, monastic writers, scholars, others, who began to describe their own society with a particular sort of scheme. Mm-hmm. And what they said is that society is divided into three parts, or three, what they called three orders. Mm-hmm. The laboratores, the bellatores, and the oratores. That's in Latin, and because mm-hmm. it's always impressive to drop a couple Latin words in the podcast. But what those correspond to is those who work, those who fight, and those who pray. And so in Western Europe, after the collapse of the Roman Empire, a way to think of how society functioned were, the people who worked and the people who fought and the people who prayed. And the notion was that this is how Christendom was sort of organized, how society was constructed, right?
Yeah, and you can see, if you think about the conditions after the fall of the Roman Empire, how this would come about. And so you have a lack of central organization. The empire provided that for all of the Mediterranean, then up into, as far north as England and in Gaul, which became France, and you don't have nearly that kind of infrastructure and organization anymore, and you don't have that kind of protection that the Roman legions provided anymore, at least not on a large scale. And so that is obviously going to cause some major changes in society. You have the downfall or decay of the major cities, Rome and at all of the others. They fall into disrepair. People move out of them. They don't become as safe and as organized anymore. You don't have the trade flowing into them in the same way that you used to. And so you have a deurbanization or a ruralization, I suppose, of society, of a lot of people. They're not getting food from far away imports. They're going to need to grow most things for themselves now. So there's a lot more agriculture. A lot more of the population is going to be working in that sector, so to speak. And so that's where you have most of those workers, the laboratories, as you're talking about, would be people who are literally working the land, growing what they need.
Yeah, just to back up what you're saying here, Corey, I think a lot of us don't appreciate the degree to which Roman imperial society was an urban society.
Right.
People lived in cities, and these cities were big. Rome itself had 1 million people in it. But Roman society, if you've ever seen the ruins of Pompeii, it was a very urbanized, organized society. Mm-hmm. It was supplied by aqueducts and, as you say, roads and trade. And that trade was really important. Mm-hmm. So we can look back and see records of trade because the Romans were really good at record keeping. And for example, wool from England was being shipped to Syria, Roman cities in Roman Syria. Mm-hmm. Fish, pickled fish from the Sea of Galilee was being sold in Paris. Mm-hmm. Pottery from Egypt or North Africa was being used in Austria. And so it was a complex society, as Corey was just saying, that really this urban complex society depended on the ability to secure trade routes, to mm-hmm. exchange commerce and all these things. And when it fell apart. Well, let's talk about that real quick, because mm-hmm. that comes into this story.
Yeah, yeah.
So the last emperor of the Western Roman Empire was a guy named Romulus Augustus, mm-hmm. who was deposed by a Germanic war chief named Odoacer in 476. Mm-hmm. Remember that date, because that's going to come up in the story. And at that point, the capital of the Western Roman Empire wasn't even Rome. It was Ravenna, which is over on the east coast of Italy. Mm-hmm. So in 476, the Western Roman Empire ceases to exist. Now, the people are all still out there. Cities are all still out there, but there's no imperial government. It'd be like if the federal government just stopped existing and we're all here, but there's no overarching structure.
No central organizing government.
There's no military. There's no post office. There's no trade. All of that money and the treasury ends. Mm-hmm. So as Corey just said, one of the reactions to that is this deurbanization. So people can no longer get their trade goods. So they have to grow their own food, and people move out of the cities into the countryside and begin to farm and doing subsistence farming. And this is where the concept, as Corey just said, of those who work are. So societies divide between those who are out there and they're raising turnips and
wheat and whatnot,
sheep and whatever. And they're doing it to serve basically their local area, sort of feed themselves and the people within a.
Yeah. And this doesn't happen overnight, of course. With the end of the Roman imperial government, it's not like the bomb getting dropped on Washington and all of a sudden everything is gone. It's a gradual deterioration, but it does affect people pretty quickly.
Yeah, in certain places, though, within a generation or so, you can see, like in southern England, when the Roman legions pulled out, within a generation, people are moving out of the cities, mm-hmm. and they're taking the stones of the basilicas and the city walls and using them to construct new homes and farms outside the city.
Yeah, so, and we mentioned, or you just mentioned, the absence of the legions. I mean, that was a huge part of Rome's ability to maintain peace and order and prosperity across a very large area. I mean, you always had outside threats. You had barbarians, so-called, from the north. You had the neighboring Persian Empire in the east. And then there's internal threats, rebellions, that kind of thing. And so if you don't have that all of a sudden, I mean, it leaves the cities hugely vulnerable. So as you're getting these barbarian invasions from the north, the cities are going to be your major targets. And that's another reason why people are going to be moving out.
Well, it's also protection. Well, you might think of like police. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you have to worry about bandits and robbers. And so if you have cities and people have to be able to travel the Roman roads because of trade, you know, you're going to send trade goods, people are going to travel, the mail, all of that stuff that has to get from one city to the next city, 50 miles across the countryside, through the forests, whatever. And now there's all of these bandits and robbers, and the legions aren't patrolling the roads can be safe. So trade stops, people stop moving, the mail doesn't get through, things begin to collapse. In fact, one of my pet theories is how many of the classic fairy tales mm-hmm. are this distant memory of that time when Rome fell. So, like, I know you love this stuff too, but right, like, you know, think about all those classic fairy tales where you can't go out into the woods. It's not safe to go out into the woods.
Well, right. It's oftentimes someone traveling between one little kingdom and another little kingdom, and everything in between is no man's land where there are wolves and witches and all kinds of dangerous stuff.
I think a lot of that comes out of this sort of collective cultural memory of the collapse of the Western Roman Empire.
Well, and to some degree, greater or lesser degree, that's the situation for hundreds of years.
Yes, it is. So the first thing is the people, the laboratoris, these are the people who work. So mm-hmm. what happens is society begins to be formed around people who basically do either subsistence farming, or if it's not just feeding their own family, but feeding the village or the series of villages. Think of a 10 or 20 mile radius, mm-hmm. and you have these little micro economies, right? And like the one third of society, or it may not divide numerically in thirds, mm-hmm. but the one contingent of society is people who are just doing the work to feed everybody.
Yep.
That brings us to the second contingent, which is the bellatoris, like from the Latin word for war.
Which is going to fill that void left by the legions.
Yeah, these are the order of people who fight. So think about that. Mm-hmm. As Corey said, you're going to have everybody moving out of the cities and everyone's moving out into the countryside and farms. And you're going to have these ex-Roman legionaries or people who with military experience. They mm-hmm. have the basic things. They have training and experience, but they have a horse and they have a sword and they have a spear and they have a breastplate and a helmet. And you go, well, that's what I know how to do. So I'll tell you what, a symbiotic relationship develops. Because while all of you are growing the turnips and the wheat and brewing the beer and raising the sheep and the wool and all that kind of stuff, how about if me and my 25 friends who used to be Roman legionaries, we'll sort of like kind of patrol around the area and, you know, stop the robbers or the bandits or the marauding Goths or whatever from killing you and stealing your...
Burning your crops,
right? And so this symbiosis develops. And this is where feudal society develops. Because eventually those guys will say, well, why don't we build a fort? So you have all these surrounding fields and people in their homes and villages. And in the middle, you'll make this big fort. And the guys who are the fighting guys, they'll sort of live in the fort. And the deal is that you give them whatever 10% or 20% of the food you raise and your sheep or whatever. And in exchange for that, they provide security.
Yeah, protection.
Protection, yeah. And this becomes the basis of this sort of feudal society, the symbiotic relationship between what would eventually become the knights, mm-hmm. right? The knightly class, the warrior class.
Lords of various kinds.
Yeah.
Counts, dukes, barons.
Yeah, well, because there's a hierarchy develops among them. Mm-hmm. So you're going to have 25 or 30 or 50 of these guys who can fight. There's going to be one guy who's the chief, right? Mm-hmm. And then without getting too far down on the whole feudal structure, right? They all have these kinds of, this hierarchy of oaths, right? So there's the guy on top and he agrees to provide protection to the people underneath him and they provide whatever. But the big point here is that these two orders, those who fight and those who work, develop this symbiotic relationship, which becomes the basis of feudal society.
Yeah, yeah.
And this emerges out of this collapse of the Roman Empire, which then creates a lot of chaos because you don't know if you're in one place and you go 20 miles or 30 miles this way, you're now in the territory of another count or duke or a little lord and his fighting guys. And society becomes kind of dangerous and fractured, right?
Yeah, there's no central organizing principle anymore. It gets broken up into many different kingdoms and other kinds of principalities.
Yeah. And that brings a certain degree of civilizational chaos and lack of security and a sense that the world is falling apart because, you know, for 800 years, the Roman Republic and then the Empire had provided a level of security and sophistication. When you talk about the deurbanization of the collapse of the Roman Empire in 476, it was another 1,000 or 1,100, 1,200 years, 1,500 years in some cases before European cities in the West became as big as they had been.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and before that trade really recovered fully.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it took 1,000, 1,200, 1,300 years. If you go back to places like London, for example, London doesn't become as big as, it's like, I think it really like the 1600s or 1700s before London becomes as big as it was at the collapse of the Roman Empire, as big of a city as it was. Right. I mean, I could just go on and on about this. Engineering, the ability of societies to build things like aqueducts and cities and trade, commerce, banking, finances, law, all those things that the Roman Empire had. People in the 500s, the 600s, the 700s have this sense that they're living after the collapse of civilization and they're building a new civilization, right?
Yeah.
So that brings us those who work and those who fight, the two of the three orders of medieval society, to the third order. Mm-hmm. And those are the orators, or
those who pray.
Those who pray. Now, this gets interesting, right? Mm-hmm. Because hopefully, Caden, you're going to see where we're going to go in this episode. We're going to set it up, and then we'll eventually get to the warrior monks. But we're setting up that you've got classes of warriors, and now we're going to start talking about the class of the monastic orders. So here's where that begins. You want to tell the story of St. Benedict?
Sure. And before we talk about St. Benedict, there are obviously antecedents to St. Benedict. It's not as if Benedict invents this out of whole cloth. Monasticism in Christianity is typically considered to begin in Egypt with St. Anthony, develops there and in Palestine and spreads throughout what was the Roman Empire, both East and West, before the fall of the Roman Empire. So this is something that's happening before that. But Benedict is especially important because he's formative for the whole of the West of monasticism and really the whole Western church. And also because he's doing what he did right after the fall of the empire. So as those two other orders are coming into being, those who work and those who fight, and as this new societal structure is coming to be, it's really Benedict in the West who's at the root of how that third order comes to be and how it interacts with those other two. And so, as we said, Benedict is born, I think, right around the time, right after that final emperor.
Yeah, he's born in the city of Nursia, mm-hmm. Norcia.
In Italy.
In Italy, in the mountains. I've been there. It's really cool. Mm-hmm. It's a cool mountain town. And he's born there, and he gets an education, and he goes to the city. And I think he wants to grow up and be a politician.
Well, yeah, because he was out in Nursia, and then he was sent to Rome as a young man for that education, as going to assume his father wanted him to be some bureaucrat or Roman official. But of course, that system is falling apart.
Well, and when the last Roman emperor, Romulus Augustus, 476 in Ravenna, because Rome is no longer even the capital of the empire. Mm-hmm. It's sort of a collapsing city. It's sort of a decaying former city.
And it has that sort of old glory, but it's not what it was.
And so that's 476. He leaves society. I mean, I think he's born like basically the same year or within a couple of years of the last Roman emperor being deposed.
Right around that time.
Because it's in 500 that he leaves society. Mm-hmm. So he would have been 24 years old.
Right. And so Benedict sees this all falling apart. He sees sort of the decrepitude of Rome and the corruption there, and he's fed up with it. He wants to live as a Christian. He wants to follow Jesus Christ, and he sees this as a terrible place to be. And so originally he goes out of the city and he joins this sort of agrarian community. And after a while, he decides that what he needs to do is go out and be a hermit, because that was the original template of monasticism in the Egyptian desert, is you're on your own. Maybe you meet up sometimes with a few other hermits in the area to pray, but that was kind of the template that he had received. So he goes out, he becomes a hermit.
Well, he goes up onto a mountain called Mountain Subiaco, and it's about halfway between Rome and Naples. So south of Rome. And it's a real famous mountain because eventually the great monastery that he founds, Monte Cassino, is there. And then in World War II, the Germans made it a defensive position and it got bombed to smithereens. But that's a whole other story. But Mount Subiaco, there was a famous battle there in World War II. And you hear about the Marines and the Army talking about the battles of Mount Subiaco. But anyway, that's just an aside.
That's anybody who goes to
Italy, anybody goes to Italy and says, oh, Mount Subiaco. But he goes up. At this time, it's just this barren mountain. And he goes up and live by himself.
And he's not looking to found anything. He doesn't want anybody with him. He doesn't want any followers. This is a project of personal holiness for him. But it doesn't work out that way. In God's providence, a lot of other young men want to join him, are inspired by his holiness and his wisdom that he's been developing over the course of this career. And what happens is that he essentially has to give into that and accept that that's what God's will is. And so he starts to found monasteries, these organized houses of men who are trying to follow Christ in poverty and chastity and obedience. We can talk more if we want to about the specifics of the monastic life, but this takes off. He founds a number of houses. Monte Cassino is the big one, but there are a bunch of others. And then in Monte Cassino, he realizes that he has to commit to paper their rule of life so that it's transferable. It can be copied easily in other places. And so that's where the famous rule of Saint Benedict comes from, is he's simply codifying all of this experience he has over decades of organizing monks practically. How should this be done so that everything works out and so that we are working towards holiness?
See, now, Corey is on a more elevated plane than my mind works, because I always come with crude examples. And my thing is that he figures out how to franchise the monastic life, much in the same way that you'd say, I'm going to open a McDonald's franchise or a Starbucks or a Chick-fil-A franchise, which would be my personal favorite. And so if you're going to open a Chick-fil-A franchise, I guess they give you these three.
There's got to be a handbook or something.
There's like a three-ring binder. And it says, this is exactly how you do
it. And you use the brand the way that it's supposed to be used. You don't change the Chick-fil-A logo, make it purple and yellow.
Everything is exactly about. You just do this. Just follow what's in the binder and you'll have your own successful Chick-fil-A.
And it's a little different than that, because it's a long time before Benedictine monasticism is super centralized, like there's someone over all of the monasteries controlling it, but it's kind of self
No, it's self-replicating.
Yeah.
Because if you follow the rule, and the rule specifies everything, it specifies the organizational chart, it specifies how they spend the day, it specifies how they spend their money, how they do everything. It's basically an operational manual for a community of monks, a religious community. And so once they have the rule, then the original idea was you would have an abbot and 12 monks. Mm-hmm. So a father, abbot means abbot from Abba, father. And so you'd have a father and 12 monks. That's sort of representing Jesus and his 12 disciples. Mm-hmm. And once you get about the 14th guy, you go, now the 14th guy is supposed to leave and go start another one. And so what happens is these things spread. They multiply like tribbles from the old Star Trek thing. And all mm-hmm. before there are monasteries, Benedictine monasteries, popping up all over Italy, into France, into Ireland, England, all over Western Europe.
And it's worth mentioning that there's also the women. They're Benedictine nuns founded by Benedict's twin sister, Scholastica. And so you have that also spreading all over Europe in parallel.
Absolutely. Parallel. You have the women's monastic movement. But I'm less interested in those for today because we're going towards...
They don't become warrior monks.
They don't become warrior monks. And Caden asked about the warrior monks. So we're setting up the warrior monk thing. Mm-hmm. But within a couple hundred years, there are hundreds, thousands of these monastic communities that have spread throughout Western Europe to the point that within a few hundred years, you could go every 10 or 20 miles throughout much of Western Europe and run into another monastery.
And they're serving a very important function in that society. We were talking about the three orders that are developing. First of all, they're obviously there praying. Both the fighting men and the working men value that. They want to be prayed for. They want to have a church in their town where someone is praying, where they can go and pray. So there's that. There's also just kind of the stabilizing influence of the monastery. The monks don't just leave. They're there. They're permanent. A community can form around them and be mutually beneficial. The monks might be farming, or later on they become preservers of knowledge in manuscript form. They take on different tasks that serve society's needs and the church's needs. And the other two orders benefit from that.
Yeah. One of the things that we have to think about to make sense out of this, and how this has to do with Catholicism, other than just we're getting to the Crusades and the warrior monks, is built into this is this deeply Catholic notion of vocation. Mm-hmm. And when we think about vocation, it comes from the Latin word voice. Mm-hmm. So calling, what you're called to do or to be. Our modern notion of self-determination, I can be whatever I want to be, do what I want to do, there's much more of a sense in which God has called you to a place in society. Mm-hmm. And the idea here is that those who work and those who fight and those who pray are all devout Christians, are all mm-hmm. devout Catholics.
It's not just if you want to be a Christian, you go to the monastery.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is why this is so important. It's going to come together in part two of this series on the warrior monks, because the idea is that the laborer, laboratores, those who work are living out their devotion to God. They're living a devout life. Mm-hmm. Their set of responsibilities are to grow the food so that everybody can eat. Mm-hmm. Without them, nobody eats. Those who fight are providing protection and security, because without them, no food would be grown and nobody could pray because they would all be dead from robbers or whatever, invaders. And those who pray are able to spend time learning, reading, studying, offering masses, so that those who work and those who fight can spend their day doing their jobs. Mm-hmm. This is super important because it is a deeply Catholic notion of vocation and how the devout life is lived out. And it's where this is going to come together in part two when you start talking about how this structure lends itself to the creation of the military orders.
Right. Another thing that I think is worth mentioning is just how the monasteries, how those who pray essentially were kind of at the cutting edge of stabilizing society and of spreading this new synthesis that was developing after the fall of the empire, because there's a missionary element to monasticism. Like you said, as soon as it gets to a certain size, it typically will branch off. They'll send some brothers out to a different spot. They're going to start a new monastery and they're going to evangelize the people in the area by example, by preaching, by prayer, all of these different ways. And then you now have a Christian community that can be formed of workers and fighters and in a place where it couldn't have existed before. You're organizing the society and you're Christianizing the society at the same time.
Yeah. In some sense, it's like spores or seeds
that can
go out and grow. And so this notion of the tripart society, the three estates or the three orders, and the concept of vocation, and that they're all sort of collaboratively or symbiotically working together to create this Christian society, this is the foundations of what came to be known as Christendom.
Yeah, you can't have the high level of sophistication and organization of the high Middle Ages until you've had that sort of leaven working through the dough for all of these hundreds of years.
One of the criticisms that people will have of the Middle Ages is, well, the monks, you weren't spreading literacy and all this kind of stuff. The Catholic Church was keeping the Bible from people or whatever. This is like that kind of Protestantism. Sure. But if you really think about it, given the times, given the technology of the times, somebody did have to grow the food all day.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it was subsistence farming. Yeah, people still do. But I mean, it took
a lot of time. It's very labor intensive.
And it took a lot of people to go out and in a very labor intensive way, sort of keep everybody fed. And the truth is the fighting part was a full-time job. Not just that you were fighting all day, every day, but you were training to fight. You were learning to fight. You were learning those practices.
Well, and there's a certain amount of just governance and administration, especially for the people at the high end of that hierarchy, that has to be done too.
If you think of them as not only the military, but the police and the sort of civil government, it was a full-time job to police things, be capable of doing that, maintaining that infrastructure, all those things. And so then you had the monasteries where you were preserving literacy and learning, the transmission of manuscripts, and then, of course, having the time every day to say prayers and intercessions and masses and those kinds of things for everybody else. So it really was this collaborative or symbiotic society, and it became in its flower. Well, eventually would flower into something that we know as Christendom today. Mm-hmm. This notion of a Christian society governed by a sort of just distribution of responsibilities and a society that you can laugh at it, but it sort of worked. It worked for centuries.
And I mean, we're not trying to misrepresent it. It's not a utopia or anything. No. It's not like everything always worked well together all the time, but it was a functioning society in which people knew what their job was and it worked.
And it was a Christian society and it was a Catholic society. And for nearly 1,000 years, it flourished in this economic system and this sort of cultural construct. A lot of what we now know as Catholicism basically was incubated for almost 1,000 years in this society. It sort of symbiotically grew up with this three-order society in the Middle Ages.
Well, yeah. I mean, the church is always going to function a little differently in different times and places. Again, that doesn't touch what the truth is or the apostolic constitution of the church. I mean, we're always going to have priests. We're always going to have lay people. We're always going to have monks and nuns, but it's going to look different based on the needs and the structures of society. I mean, we're only 500 years or so into the modern period, half as long maybe as the medieval period lasted, and the church has adapted in many ways.
Well, I'm saying
the modern
it can.
Period.
I'm just saying it flourishes everywhere, but it'd be like if I looked back at my life and I say, well, for half my life, I lived in a certain place or had a certain kind of job. I mean, obviously that shaped profoundly who I am.
Yeah, it leaves a mark.
And during this time, the fighting men are fighting off, and this is where we're going to start kind of winding this one down and setting up the next one, because of course they're fighting the bandits and the robbers and the witches in the woods and all that kind of stuff. We might call as police functions, and they're fighting each other a lot.
And like we said, it's not perfect.
Because fighting guys like to fight each other when they're bored or whatever, and they're fighting for land and control. But a lot of their efforts really become defending this Christendom society against pagan invaders. And there are two or three sets. In the earliest part of this, you still had the barbarian invaders from the north that were coming down.
And eventually, as they're evangelized, I mean, they become the
part of the society.
Medieval Europe. They become
Christian. So if you look
Christian
at like
Europe.
The Franks, you look at Clovis, when Clovis accepts Christianity and becomes baptized, he basically takes the Frankish tribes and turns them into what we're describing or converts them to that. But then you had the Vikings, the Northmen, who moved throughout Europe, not just along the coast, but deep into the continent via the river system. And a lot of them are fighting off them. But then the third threat is the Muslims. the Muslim invaders, because by the 700s, they are coming up through Spain and into France. And famously, Charles Martel at the Battle of Tours in 732 fights off using the fighting men and with those who work and pray supporting him, he's able to fight off this invading Muslim army that got within 100 miles of Paris.
And that gets the Muslim armies off of the backs of most of Western Europe, but it's another 500 right. years or more until Spain yep. itself is taken back from yep. from Muslim conquest.
The reason I wanted to bring that up is it's starting to set up this next episode, because mm-hmm. what's going on while the Three Order Society is developing, Islam is rising in a particular, well, all around the Mediterranean, mm-hmm. but particularly it is taking control of the Eastern Mediterranean, and it's going to eventually here take Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. And once it takes Jerusalem, that's going to set up the Crusades. And then what's going to happen is that this society, the Society of the Three Orders, those who fight and those who pray and those who work, is going to have to respond to the Muslims taking Jerusalem. And in 1095, the Pope is going to call for a crusade to take Jerusalem back. And this society is going to respond out of its social constructs, out of its worldview, out of its infrastructure. How does this society respond to that in the Crusades? Well, one of the ways is the military orders, where you merge two ideas, those who fight and those who pray, mm-hmm. and they become sort of this weird hybrid thing of guys who are praying while they fight or fighting while they pray, right? Mm-hmm. And it's pretty cool. And that's what we're going to talk about in the next part of this conversation, which will be the next episode. Mm-hmm. And all of this is in response to Caden's great question. So here's a couple of things to kind of clean up housekeeping things before we move on. First, I'm going to put two links in the show notes for this, or the episode description. The first is we did an episode about the Crusades.
Yes.
And if you want to listen to that, because we don't have time to cover everything about the Crusades in the next episode, I'm going to focus on the fighting monks. But if you want to hear that episode, I'll put the link in the show notes. And then the other is a few years ago with Lakeshore Academy, we did a short video on basically, what did monks do all day? Mm-hmm. And it really tells the story of the monastic life in Benedict. And it also tells how there was a constant movement to reform the monasteries right, right. because they would become successful and then need reformation. And that's a real fun video. It's called What Did Medieval Monks Do All Day? And I'm going to put that link in the show notes. You may want to watch that. And you're going to want to join Corey and I for the next episode as we talk about how the Three Order Society responded to the fall of Jerusalem, the Crusades. And one of its responses was the creation of the warrior monks. And that's going to be pretty fun, the Templars and the Hospitallers. Hey, would you do me a favor, please, right now, would you go and rate and review this podcast? If you're on Spotify, which is our most popular platform for this podcast, you can give us a rating. If you're on Apple Podcasts, you can give us a rating and you can give us a review. The ones on Apple Podcasts really, really help us. They help us move up in search. They help us to be eligible for sponsorship and other kinds of things. So please take the time to rate and review. You can also go to our website, consideringcatholicism.com. You'll find all of the episodes and some videos and all kinds of cool stuff there that you can look at. From there, you can send a message or post a comment. You can also support the podcast financially. That's what makes it possible for us to have the time and tools to do this. What else can they do? Oh, and if you have a question about warrior monks or anything else, and like Caden, you would like to send it in, send it to consideringcatholicism@gmail.com. Love to hear your stories, love to hear your comments, and love to hear your questions. We'll try to answer as many on the show as we can. Some will answer via email, and some are just in the pile waiting to be answered.
We'll get to them eventually.
So please be patient, but really, really appreciate that. So thanks for joining us. God bless, and we'll see you in the next episode and Warrior Monks Part 2.
Yeah, looking forward to it.